This program is brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U at Stanford University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.
All right, my friends. We got exactly this far last time. So have your text absolutely at the ready. In fact, have it open to the opening page of Apology. While I just present us with a horrible final context of our text. Our text was written by Plato. Plato of Athens, just as Socrates came from Athens. We happen to know that Plato came from a very, very distinguished family, one of the great and mighty of Athens. And like Socrates, he was a kind of bull of a man. He was a great wrestler in his youth. He probably would have wrestled on the Stanford great wrestling team maybe 197 pounds, something like that. And I'm sure he would have gone undefeated and would have become NCAA champ. He became one of the many aristocratic, rich young men around Socrates, whose presence around Socrates caused such disturbance and hostility in the establishment of Athens. And we have to believe, because the evidence is so universal, that Plato must have been the genius among Socrates' disciples. He was there at the trial, of which the Apology purports to be Socrates' defense speech. And Plato saw the Athenian democracy put his great master and lord to death. He never forgave the Athenian democracy for this. And he seems to have taken up as a life's mission almost as soon as Socrates was dead, which of course happens very shortly after the end of the Crito. Plato seems to have taken up as his life's mission to record or to remember and to put down all the philosophy of Socrates and to take it before as broad an audience as possible. And along the way, if we had the chance here, and when you have the chance elsewhere to read extensively in Plato, you will see that Plato is anything but an ardent democrat. Democrat in the sense of believer in the virtues of democracy, because he had seen democracy kill Socrates. So about a decade or so after Socrates' death in 399, Plato founded a school, a kind of research academy. It was called the Academy, but that's a place name. Academy refers to a particular place in Athens. But our word and the meaning of our word academy comes from the institute that Plato established in that locale of the academy. And Plato's academy lasted for about 1,000 years. It was only officially closed down forever in the middle of the 6th century AD by the Byzantine Emperor Justinian. Even before, and at the academy, Plato discussed and taught over the next 40 years, down to his death in the early 340s, philosophy. Block capital philosophy. It is absolutely clear that Plato took Socrates' philosophical doctrines, of which probably the most fundamental four are the ones that we got to just at the end of last time. Plato took these and others and expanded them and developed them into what we would want to call a fully Platonic system of philosophy. But the trouble is that in every single surviving work that we have by Plato, Plato makes Socrates the dramatic center of the work. And all the words of philosophy come from Socrates, as Plato constructs it, never from Plato. And since, in a very early work, which surely the Apology is, and surely the Crito is, both of these, all scholars agree, written and disseminated in the years just after the death of Socrates, even before the foundation of the Academy. Since in these early works, these early Platonic works, like the Apology and like the Crito, Plato seems surely, as accurately as he can, with perhaps some stylistic and rhetorical tricks along the way, but as accurately as he can, really to record and to bring back the words of Socrates, the beliefs of Socrates. So we can look at the Apology and Crito and say, written by Plato, philosophy of Socrates. But as the works of Plato that we have, such as the Republic, for instance, come out later and later from the Academy, then, but Socrates is still the dramatic center, the great, huge, horrible Platonic question is, when does the figure of Socrates begin to utter the philosophy of Plato? And I just put that out before you because that's something that you'll have to wrestle with your whole life. One example. One of the most famous Platonic philosophical doctrines is the theory of forms. That everything that we see, everything that we are, is imperfect, temporary, but it goes back to an idealized form. This is an example of a lectern, but it's an imperfect lectern. But somewhere there is the concept of the perfect lectern. And those nice white sneakers, they're not as white as they should be, not tied quite perfectly. The socks are a little messy. But my friend has on sneakers and socks, but they're lousy, grubby sneakers and socks. But why do we call them sneakers and socks? Because we have a memory, a concept of the perfect sneakers and socks. And probably these beautiful brown shoes and those beautiful socks come as close as can be done in the mortal life to perfect shoes and socks. But no one can ever establish whether the theory of forms began as Socratic or is essentially only Platonic. All right, that's a massive problem. And with that massive problem, my perfect shoes take me down here. We take off this. We put on this. And on we go. Let me be sure that you realize something immediately, and it has to do with these words here, Last Days of Socrates. That's the title of our book. It's listed in our syllabus. That's how you found it in the bookstore. I hope that at least in your own minds you have crossed out Last Days of Socrates as a real title long ago. Last Days of Socrates is a ploy by Penguin Classics for you to buy, which of course you've now done because we've required it, this particular volume that contains four Platonic works all having to do with the Last Days of Socrates. But it's an artifice. The texts here are Euthyphro, Apology, Crito, and Phaedo. And our first text, Apology, the English word comes directly from the Greek word apologia. But the English word apology means to be apologetic or to create something that is apologetic. And that is, as you know now, though you wouldn't have known it necessarily when you just saw the title, Apology, but now you know that is absolutely the opposite of Socrates' whole bearing and rhetorical and persuasive strategies in his speech, correct? And in Greek, apologia means literally a defense speech. So it is his defense speech. It might be, in our terms, a defense speech that has apologetic elements in the English sense, or it might not. But the Greek word apologia, from which the English title apology comes, has nothing to do in its Greek meaning with something apologetic. It is simply a defense speech. So now our job for the next bit is to examine a few aspects of the Socrates' apology as brought to us several years later by Plato, who was there and heard it, but who, of course, I hope you would agree, of course, had no access to a stenographic transcript or anything like this. It was all in his memory, and in the memory of hundreds of people who were there, someone just yell out, please, how many jurors themselves were there?
501.
That's great. A lot of you yelled 500. A lot of you, or at least some of you, yelled. I heard one especially insistent voice yelling 501. You're both right. Isn't this wonderful? Everybody can be right. No one will ever be able to say whether it was a jury of 500 or 501. Typically, and of course, just think of that fact. How would you like to be before a jury of your peers of 500 or 501? To have the concept of a jury of 12 of our peers have the good sense, the resoluteness, the energy, the concentration to do something just about any one of us if we've done something bad or in trouble for some reason. That's, in my view, horrifying enough. But 500? 501? Often, Athenian juries, they weren't always that big. They could be as small as 50. Often, Athenian juries in fact, deliberately had an odd number, such as 501, so that if everybody was there and voting, there could not be a tie. But if there was a tie, if, for instance, the number was 500 and it was tied, the tie went in favor of the runner, just as it does with us. So a tie meant acquittal, and we know from the second part of the apology, the part after Socrates is found guilty and he proposes a counter penalty, we know that he was convicted by what kind of majority? 60 votes. So it was either 280 to 220 or 280 to 221. A switch of only 30 votes would either have brought about a tie, in which case there would be acquittal, or would have brought about acquittal by one vote, by one real vote. It was not a runaway massacre in terms of his finding of being found guilty. Yes?
Could anybody who wanted to serve on the jury, or they have to be selected?
The question is, who served on the jury? Absolutely important, relevant question. Male citizens of varying economic classes, in fact, quite a lot of sort of worker bee type male citizens, were selected by lot. It was very much like going into the jury pool. Now, almost all of you are too young to be called yet, but as you go through life and you get called time by time, excuse me? You can call it 18? You've been called. All right. Everyone's been called. This sounds like a revival meeting. All right. So you've all been called. What progress since when I was 18, I couldn't even spell jury. In fact, probably most people still can't. So it's like a jury pool. You go into the local county courthouse, and you're there, and then your name may be drawn for one particular case of the day or another, right? So in Athens, your names were pulled out, and you were assigned to a particular court for a particular kind of case or a particular run of cases. So the 500 or 501 jurors were male Athenian citizens of varying economic and social classes, selected by lot. In that sense, a truly democratic cross-sectioning of the male citizenry of Athens. Okay. Someone help me here, because every word I just said was golden, but I started someplace else. Where did I? Pardon? Yeah, you got, all right, well, forget it. I'm sure whatever I did, I'll get back to. All right, so, but since this terrific question about the composition of the jury has come up, let me just give you a couple of other facets of what Socrates was facing here. I know where I started. I started with all the hundreds of people who were there, like Plato, at the trial, 500 or so, of whom were actually jurors, but hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of others just sitting and looking on, as indeed was Plato and a number of Socrates' disciples. All right. Now, it's critical for us to understand that in Athens, in Athenian law courts, the juries were not only responsible for ascertaining fact as evidence, but they acted as judges, in that whereas in our courts it's the judges who interpret and advise the juries on points of law, correct? But there was no judge there. So this massive, humongous jury of motley Athenian male citizens was also responsible for understanding, interpreting, defining law as a given trial went along. Now, just consider what a terrible position that set of facts put Socrates in, and puts our evaluation of what Plato represents in the Apology in, for this particular trial. Let's ask ourselves first, what were the charges against Socrates? And all of you now know, and it comes up in the trial, Socrates is accused Some legal analysts and scholars define it as two charges. Others define it as three charges, or two charges with the second one subdivided. So corruption of the youth, that's plain. That's one big heading. And in fact, it is the most fundamental heading of the charges. But the second heading, either on its own or subdivided, is impiety, correct? And that can either just be heading number two, or you can say that it was a sort of double charge. Impiety against existing gods, and impiety with regard to creating new gods. Right? Now, if I were to say to you, what do you think in late 5th century or the beginning of the 4th century in Athens, what constituted legally impiety? What constituted legally corruption of the youth? You would have an exceedingly difficult time answering those questions if you were a citizen in 400 BC or 399 BC. You could say for sure, easily, impiety certainly includes desecration of altars, of holy objects. That would be impiety against which a formal charge of impiety, just such as has now been brought against Socrates, could be leveled. But of course, Socrates isn't charged with that at all, is he? He hasn't gone out and put graffiti on the Parthenon or anything like that. His impiety consists in not respecting the establishment gods and of creating a kind of new set of divinities. How would you define corruption of the youth? Well, you would certainly, in 399 BC, say that you could have a formal writ against you of corruption of the youth for pederasty. I'm not talking about homosexual love, because homosexual love, as I'm sure you all know, was absolutely what happened in ancient Greek society. Bisexual lifestyle is much too flip a term. All Athenian males, all Greek males, were supposed to grow up being introduced to the basic fundamental concept of love, of passion, of friendship, through male relationships and female relationships. But if you had to choose, the most perfect love relationship was male with male. And if you ever bothered to think about it, female with female, but who of us Athenian males would care about that? As long as the women were there to get married and bear children. So, and that was quite different from pederasty. But what is Socrates accused of? He's certainly not accused of pederasty. He is accused of turning the minds of the proper young men of Athens in new directions that would stand perhaps to undermine the fabric of Athenian society. In other words, my friends, and as you return to what I assume will be a continuation of discussion of the Apology today and tomorrow, as well as the Crito, reread yet again both works, but in the Apology, please reread it and think about it again with these horrible facts of what kind of court and what kind of issues Socrates had to think about and deal with as he delivered his defense speech, a speech about the way he has lived his life. He can't answer the charges. There is no way for him to deny. And you will know that he does not deny explicitly the charges against him. All he can do is ask his accusers, what do you mean by impiety? What do you mean by corrupting the youth? Is it corrupting the youth for me to talk and ask questions and answer questions? Is it impiety for me to talk. I observe, he says, the proper rites of the Athenian religious life. So Socrates, historically, in a vast area of weakness of Athenian law, had to deal with a life and potentially a life and death charge which he could not answer. That's very tough. So what does he do? Well, here I want to talk just for a minute or two about one of the, it's down here at the bottom of the page, Socratic irony, but you take some big mark or a pen you have and you put Socratic irony and you put it right up at the top of the page and you underline it about 8 times. You cannot hope to understand or at least to be intelligently bewildered by what goes on in the Apology if you do not put absolutely in the center of it the practice of Socratic irony. One example. It is ironic at a deep structural level that Socrates poses, turn to the first page, page 39, right there at the beginning in the wonderfully helpful section heading 17A. For my own part, I was almost carried away by them, my accusers. Their arguments were so convincing. On the other hand, scarcely a word of what they said was true. I was especially astonished at one of their many misrepresentations, the point where they told you that you must be careful not to let me deceive you, implying that I am a skillful speaker. And then a few lines further down, when it becomes obvious that I have not the slightest skill as a speaker, unless, of course, by a skillful speaker, they mean one who speaks the truth. So at a structural, rhetorical level, there is pervasive, fundamental Socratic irony of the following nature. Socrates poses as a non-speaker, as someone who doesn't know how to speak, as someone who will just be swept away by the clever, powerful arguments of the prosecutors, as an absolute novice. That's his pose. But what Socrates does, or at least what Plato's reconstruction of Socrates' defense speech does, I believe it to be thoroughly historical, not every word, but in such a big category as this, Socrates then proceeds to give a perfect oratorical defense speech. And I've just written down here all the standard parts of the perfectly sophisticated, beautifully organized law court defense speech that you would expect from a skilled speaker at the end of the 5th century BC. A polished beginning, that's what you're in the middle of here. Then what is called the prothesis, which sets out the way the arguments are going to be handled. That's when Socrates says, well, first of all, I'll go against the popular caricatures of me, and then I'll go against the charges. So that's outlining the organization of the argument. Beautifully put out, immaculately put out. Then the refutation. This is the central part when he goes at Meletus and says, how can you accuse me of this? How can you accuse me of that? Full refutation. Then typically a digression. Now, normally in defense speeches, the digression would be a part where the defendant appeals to the pity, the compassion of the jurors. Sometimes they bring up members of their family who cry in front of the jury. It's just absolutely great. Now, notice just on our way to a second deep Socratic irony that in the digression, the digression in the Apology is that part where Socrates talks about his sacred mission. What his sacred mission to Athens is. Socrates as the gadfly. That, in terms of organization, is Socrates' digression part of this beautifully polished defense speech. And finally, though this organization only takes as far as the first verdict of guilty, the other succeeding parts, the proposal of the counter penalty and then the final set of remarks by Socrates, are, so to speak, outside, beyond, after the main organization of the main speech. So the peroration is when Socrates sums up before the first vote is taken. A great, masterful law court defense speech by a man who says, I have no skill in speaking. It is the standard rhetorical ploy of a great speaker. So we're in the presence of a monumental Socratic irony just that far. Now, deep Socratic irony number two, which is as far as we can take it here for the Apology. You have to be asking yourselves, I'm sure you have been, I can't believe there is any of the great seminars that hasn't been wrestling with this already. You have to keep asking yourselves, did Socrates want to be acquitted? How sincere, as opposed to ironic, is Socrates' overall appeal saying, you need to acquit me? Think of a couple of other aspects of this level of Socrates' defense speech. If you're sincere in your defense speech, which your words say you're sincere about, namely, you should acquit me, if you're sincere about that, then why would you, in this topsy-turvy, vague, huge courtroom surrounding where you can't even answer the charges directly because they themselves are vague, why would you say openly, piercingly to your jury of 500, I'm the most valuable thing you have in the city. I'm the gadfly that barely keeps the unruly democratic horse sort of back on the right track. Why would you say, when the time comes in which you, the defendant, are allowed to propose a counter penalty, why would you say, well, I actually don't think I'd like to propose anything at all, but if I must, what I propose is that as opposed to punishing me, you support me for life with state funds. Why would you do that? Why would you keep saying in various ways throughout the work, no one of you, my jurors, can really tell whether it will be better or worse for me to be found guilty and, if need be, go to my death, because who of you can tell whether it is better to live or to die, accompanying repeated Socratic claims that at all points, in all ways, totally inflexibly, you have to speak the truth, you have to speak in terms of and aiming toward justice. There is no flexibility around any of those items. I am doing it by strong inference. All of you out there don't have a clue how to know about justice and how to award a finding that is just in this case. So unless you analyze this speech, which you're perfectly, legitimately able to do if you so choose, as a totally sincere speech, The words say what they mean, and they mean what they say. Unless you go that route interpretively, then you have to mess yourselves around at some undefined but surely complex, imponderable sort of Socratic irony. He's saying one thing, but he means to make this statement about his way of life something quite different. He was convicted. He was convicted to death. And our second early Platonic work recording the last weeks, the last days of Socrates is the Crito. Now, this overhead, the last page of your handout, is so beautiful, not only in the McCall font, but it is such an exemplary outline of the structure and the basic arguments of the Crito that I'm just going to let that stand as is. Hold this last page, as all these four pages, close to your hearts forever, or at least until sometime in December. What I want to have us ask ourselves, just as we have our last several minutes here today, is the following. In this dialogue, the apology is a speech, though he questions his accusers along the way, and accurately or not, their answers supposedly are recorded, but the Crito illustrates Plato's standard way of examining and exploring the philosophy of Socrates, maybe in quotes, namely through the dialogue form. And in Plato's dialogue form, it is absolutely standard, and it happens here, for Socrates' interlocutor, or often interlocutors, here Crito, to carry the force of the argument for the first section, whatever amount of the whole thing that first section is, and then gradually for Socrates to take over to rebut the arguments, to show that the arguments through dialectical exchange, that the arguments of his interlocutor are just based on faulty knowledge or non-knowledge. So we're back to the Socratic principle. You have to go back and admit your ignorance before you can start to put together a true argument or system of knowledge, of truth, of virtue. So that structure is absolutely illustrated here. And then in the great final half of the Crito, one of the most glorious legal arguments of all time in the history of legal argument takes place. Legal scholars to this very day incorporate the arguments of the personified laws in Plato's Crito as a basic foundational start to the history of legal argument. Now, the argument of the laws, as you all know now, is very strong, and it's an argument that you may all totally disagree with. And it's the argument of the analogy of the authority of the laws to the authority of your father, your parents, but your father. Socrates clearly is using, it seems to me, is using this argument as something that he believes in and hopes to persuade Crito to believe in as well. And of course, on the very, very last page of the Crito, Plato has Socrates say to Crito, well, is there anything else you want to say? And then typically the interlocutor says, oh, no, Socrates, I can't think of anything else to say. well, all right then I guess I'll just go on to my death. And the dialogue ends. But what you have to think about and argue and argue and argue over is, in a big legal philosophical way, do you believe the analogy? Now, let me just give one statement of support to the analogy, just to feed in to your discussions, and then we're unfortunately at an end today. The laws claim that they are universal in terms of both legal and moral authority in Athens, where Socrates lives and has chosen to live. So the laws claim exactly what 60% of you refused to agree with the other on Tuesday. You have chosen to live with us. Therefore, as with your father, you have chosen to regard us as authoritative in putting out the laws under which you shall live, so long as you're in our house. And further, even if these laws of ours sometimes are unjust, you may not back away from them as a result, because to back away even from unjust laws, when you have agreed to live under us, is to do injustice to yourself. It is to break the agreement that you made with us, and that is sacred and solemn above all injury to yourself. Because as long as you abide by your commitments, then any punishment, any death sentence, doesn't do injury to your soul and to your quality of life. That's the argument. So I expect and predict that there will be marvelous, sophisticated discussions of this. I want to just close by saying that you'll recall the other day I lavished fulsome praise on the good Professor Evans. Oh, think of this in that great talk last Thursday and so on. Here I want to say that he needs to rethink one of his basic points, namely that only literature aims at beauty in presentation as opposed to philosophy and history. I want to claim that at least the philosophical writings of Plato that we've now been studying are a beautiful, formal specimen of great literary beauty, and he can't say me no because the time is up. Thank you.
The preceding program was brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U and is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of the Leland Stanford Junior University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.